I have to go upstairs and record something again, so
quiet
and do not
smash anything
and do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
Hi, you're listening to Pandemic, a new podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Cullum O'Mungoyne, and most days of the week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. The sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat sometimes, as correspondents and I will be recording this, in many cases, on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Wednesday, June 3rd, and at the time of recording this episode in the early evening, the number of people who have died around the world with COVID-19 is approaching 382,000. Total infections stand at over 6.4 million. Here in Ireland, the deaths of three more people from coronavirus have been recorded in the last 24 hours, bringing the total here to 1,659. 47 more confirmed, suspected or probable infections have been notified to health authorities. 25,111 is where that total now stands. Later in this episode, we're going to look at what's known about Ireland's planned contact tracing app. And spoiler alert, listener,
the first concern about the COVID app, as we know of what it is at the moment, is that we don't actually know what it is at the moment.
Very little is the answer. But we will look at some of the issues that such apps have to contend with in the field of privacy, uptake, and whether they really work at all. Also, Sweden's world-famous epidemiologist gives the country a middling grade and says, with the benefit of hindsight, it could have done better. Our Europe editor Tony Connolly will look at that and the lifting of some of Europe's border restrictions. But first, Fergal Bauer is our health correspondent on some of what's happening here. All right, Fergal, how are you?
I'm good. We're well into dealing with the virus now in this country. I think people know an awful lot more about it than they did at the start. That does help with understanding, certainly about the guidance on social distancing, which seems to be a part of everyday life for most people when you see them on the street, some wearing masks, some not wearing masks.
And on that subject, Fergal, I might be going to the supermarket later. So what's changed for me from today?
Well, the Minister for Health has said today that there's room for improvement regarding the wearing of face coverings. Now, you'll recall that from both the government end of things and the National Public Health Emergency Team, the wearing of face masks is an advisory. So it was advised, not a requirement, but advised that people might wear these if they're on public transport or going to places where it's going to be difficult to social distance. But I think it's fair to say there have been mixed views from the medical point of view on the wearing of masks. And indeed, the World Health Organization didn't take a definitive position on it. It certainly wasn't asking that people be required to. And the view also being that in terms of medical masks and the high quality masks, that those will be kept for the health system and health staff who are at most at risk. Because there's concern about wearing a mask might give somebody a false sense of security. You can touch your face a bit more with them. There's a certain way of taking them off, and they should only be worn once in terms of the general face coverings. And if there's an over-reliance on masks, there might be less adherence to social distancing and hygiene measures. On the other hand, people feel comfortable wearing a mask if they're going out in public. But there might be a concern that perhaps the government line is somewhat stronger in language at the moment. That may not have been intended. But
yeah,
the public
it certainly
advice,
sounded that way.
It does. And you could think that potentially that could open up room for confrontation in public places where an individual wearing a mask might raise the matter with someone who's not wearing a mask. And there are medical reasons why people can't wear masks, particularly young people, but others too. So the wearing of a mask is an advisory by government, and certainly that's been the public health message, not a requirement. I don't think that's changed, but some of the language seemed to change a little bit today.
All right, and if you want a how-to to make your own face covering, Mary Fitzgerald from Make and Do, the popular children's slot on RTE television in the 1980s, has done a short video on the RTE website about that, so you can check in with that and possibly make your own. Fergal, you were at the briefing there yesterday evening, and one of the things that came up was the number of people in hospital is up, and the issue of infections while in hospital was also touched on. So can we deal with the numbers in hospital first and the intensive care unit numbers as well?
Certainly, if we look at hospitals, there's 422 patients in hospital with confirmed or suspected COVID-19. That's actually up 92 cases on the previous 24 hours, and it's principally due to a rise in suspected cases. So these would be cases where a swab result is awaited by the hospital. Some may prove positive, some won't prove positive. Also, the numbers in intensive care, they're steady. They always are slow to reduce, but you wouldn't want to see them rise any further. The overall trend in terms of the number of deaths, the number of new cases, remains relatively low, which points us in an encouraging direction in terms of the phase two lifting of restrictions next Monday.
And Fergal, a GP from County Monaghan, Dr. Ilona Duffy, speaking on Morning Ireland earlier, talking about how things were as busy in her surgery as they had ever been, or indeed they were at the peak. There is still concern about certain clusters in certain areas, particularly workplaces, as she was saying.
Yes, I think Kevin Monaghan has been particularly named, and Dr. Ilona Duffy works up in that region, and she was saying, if I recall correctly, that she'd seen 6 cases, so that should certainly be a cluster, and some of these relating to factories. So there still seems to be a problem, and maybe some of that issue surrounds the conditions and where people are living together, those workers are living. And there may be communications issues in terms of, you know, being able to fully communicate with some of the workers. Maybe that English isn't their first language, and maybe more work needs to be done to let people know the risks and take precautions. But those spikes and those outbreaks are a concern because they have the potential to spread quite rapidly.
All right, Fergal, thanks very much.
Take care of yourself, Colm.
Now, shortly, we're going to have a look at what's been going on in Sweden today. But right now, we're going to have a look at contact tracing apps. The area of contact tracing is going to become increasingly relevant as restrictions lift. Now, back in March, the HSE said it was working on an app to help with this. Still no sign, but it's in the early stages of being tested. Adam McGuire of our business desk has written a couple of lengthy pieces on this. So this afternoon, to hear what he's learned, I gave him a shout. Hey, how are you? You well?
Yeah, not too bad.
So you've been looking at the area of contact tracing for a piece on RTE, which I found very interesting. So we decided to give you a call and talk about it. Give us an idea of what kind of tracing apps are out there. What are they for? Where have they been tried? And what are the models?
Yeah, well, a number of countries have already launched tracing apps. Singapore was the first with an app in late March, but it's been followed by a lot of other countries, Australia, France, Switzerland, and most recently Italy. For the most part, the apps rely on a phone's Bluetooth connection. So the idea is that your phone repeatedly pings out a code over a short range. At the same time, it's listening out for a similar message from others. And then when you come close to someone else who has the app, you exchange codes, and that's counted essentially as a close contact. And then if someone lets their app know that they've gotten COVID-19, anyone who's come into contact with them in the past 2 weeks gets a notification to say they're at risk. So the idea is that it allows you to know when you've come into close contact with someone who has the virus, you are then able to go and get tested, or you're brought to the attention of the contact tracing team who get in touch with you. There is a difference of approach with different apps then in terms of what happens with the data. So some use what's called a centralized model, and that means that every one of those little interactions between two users gets sent back to a central server, and then it's checked against a database of who has the infection and who doesn't. Other apps use a decentralized model. The idea there is that very little information is actually sent back to a server, and all of the cross-checking is done on the phone itself. And then some apps also use a user's location data on top of all of that. The argument for that is that it might help people to identify clusters or hotspots in certain areas if they know exactly where people are located when they're carrying the virus around.
And who has developed the apps? Have they been done by private companies? Have they been developed by states, or has it been a mix of both?
A mix of both, really. In the Irish instance, it's a developer called Nearform. They're a Waterford-based developer. They've done a lot of technology for some big names like IBM, Walmart, Condé Nast. We don't know an awful lot about the specifics of the Irish app at the moment. The HSE hasn't really given much detail about it. As Dr. Palmo Palmieri from University College Cork explains, that makes analysis of it very difficult at the moment.
It's very hard to say without having clear details of what the app will do. In general, what I would say is that the fact that the specifications are not available is a problem in itself. Now, it may be the case now because they're not fully defined yet, and that would be okay. But I would prefer the code, or at the very least, a very detailed specification of how the application works, what protocols does it use, in what way, what information is collected, where is it stored, is it ever sent somewhere else, I mean, that is something that we really need to have in order to analyze what are the potential consequences for privacy.
Do we even know the basics, Adam, as to whether or not we've gone for the model where the data would be stored centrally or decentralized, where most of the data would reside on the phone and only called into play if somebody has an infection? Do we know even that much about it?
We do know that much. What we've been told so far is that they're using a framework that's been co-developed by Apple and Google, and that requires that you follow that decentralized model. It also bars the use of location data. So we know almost certainly that won't be a feature of the Irish app, and that the amount of data being sent back, at least from the contact tracing element, will be fairly limited.
Anywhere where data is stored, there's going to be a privacy consideration. So can you give us what are the main concerns, or what concerns have been raised about the storage of data and access to it?
Yeah, a lot of issues crop up with this kind of thing when any kind of data is being requested by a user. And I suppose part of the problem, because we know so little about the app, is we don't know the answer to the question of where is the data going to be stored, where is what exactly kind of data is going to be asked for. So location data is probably off the table, but that doesn't mean that the HSE can't ask for, say, contact details or even your address, which might have some validity because they might want to follow up with potential cases. But we need to know exactly what's being asked. The HSE has said that they're going to put in a document with the Data Protection Commissioner so that they can have oversight over what exactly is going on in the app, and that they're also going to release the source code, which will allow people to look at the back end of what's going on. So the problem, I suppose, is that because we don't know exactly what the app is doing, we don't know what it's going to ask for, and that's where there could be a privacy implication, as Dara O'Brien from Castlebridge Consulting explains.
Well, I think the first concern about the COVID app, as we know of what it is at the moment, is that we don't actually know what it is at the moment. It is either an exposure notification and contact tracing app, or it is an app that's doing symptom tracking as well. The guidance from the European Data Protection Board, and again, the guidance we've issued to clients, there needed to be specificity and clarity as to what the app was doing, or what any contact tracing app is doing anywhere in the world. And the functions should be limited just to the contact tracing process. Adding in lots of other bells and whistles increases complexity and also distracts people from what the app is ultimately aimed to do, which is to speed up the human contact tracing process.
There's also a question around the tools that are used as part of the app itself. And this is where, you know, the issue of maybe off-the-shelf technology comes into play. There are a lot of third-party tools that you can, you know, pick from when you're putting your own app together, but they can create privacy issues even if it's unintentional. For example, it was found that the Singapore app was using Google services for some of the behind-the-scenes work. So that meant that Google's machines were actually seeing all of the data flowing, as well as the Singapore Health Authority. So that creates a potential problem too.
And apart from the legal aspect of things, which is, of course, preeminent, and the Data Protection Commissioner here would have a look at that, there is an element of reassurance. There needs to be a high level of trust, basically, before anyone would think about downloading the app, although that's obviously not always the case with social media and other companies, but that does play into something that they want a high uptake in.
Yeah, absolutely. There's obviously a lot of distrust around government use of data in Ireland, but really around the world. And I suppose some people will worry that this would be a purposeful attempt to actually find out more about what people are doing. But others would worry that even with the best intentions, governments and companies have a bad habit of mishandling data and losing it or having it stolen on them. So it will be crucial that the HSE can reassure people that this app is as minimally invasive as possible. It's not going to be uninvasive. It has to find out something about people and what they're doing in order to work. But they also have to show that the data that they are taking is being useful in the fight against the virus.
And what kind of uptake is needed? I mean, people have heard before during the context of the COVID-19 crisis about herd immunity and what level of the population needs to be infected. But what's the equivalent uptake needed for this app to be effective?
Yeah, there's a bit of debate around that. Researchers at Oxford are saying 60%, which is a mammoth task to get 60% of the population to download a single app. The Minister for Health, Simon Harris, puts it at a seemingly more manageable 25%. But to put that into some context, that's roughly the same percentage of the population that had a Facebook account at the end of last year. So still not an easy task by any stretch. And a complicating factor in all of this is that some people will be excluded from using the app altogether, even if they want to download it. So by design, it's a smartphone app. And in general, it has to work on ones that are no more than 5 years old. And if we look at some research done by Comreg last year, 84% of people in Ireland own a smartphone. So that means 60% won't be able to download this app. And of those that have a smartphone, just under 10% of those devices are 5 years old or more. So they probably won't be able to download the app.
Right. And if you can imagine there's a high correlation between the 16% that don't have smartphones, apart from small children, older people who are extremely vulnerable to COVID-19 would feature strongly in that cohort too.
Yeah, the numbers get much worse as you go up the age spectrum. So according to that Comreg study, just 46% of people over 65 on a smartphone, so less than half. And of the ones that do, they're less inclined to update those devices. So 27%, more than a quarter of the people over 65 who do own a smartphone have one that's more than 5 years old. So that narrows the pool dramatically in terms of people over 65 who will actually be able to download the app, even if they're inclined to do so. And also bear in mind the HSE is saying that the app isn't going to be available to those under 16, which it says is in order to comply with the digital age of consent. So that cuts out that section of the population as well. So you have a limited pool and you need a lot of those people to actually download the app for this to work.
All right. And even so, we'll say 25% to 60% of people were to take it up in the best case scenario and all the privacy is protected. What about the other practical considerations? When is somebody a contact and when are they not a contact? And to what degree can an app tell that?
Yeah, this is perhaps the biggest challenge of all, because as you say, even if you allay all those privacy concerns and even if you get complete buy-in from the public, there are still doubts about whether the technology underneath it all actually works in the way it's supposed to. So, for example, a Bluetooth signal could go through glass or a wall. So if you're sitting on the opposite side of a wall to someone, that could be counted as a close contact. You could be, for example, sitting on the bus and you're stopped at a set of lights and the person on the other side of the glass picks you up as a close contact as well, even though you've never actually come into direct contact.
Anybody sitting in their car who's seen Dublin bus being offered as a hotspot nearby would probably recognize that feeling.
Exactly. Yeah. But even then, when you're talking about people actually in the same room or in the same space, there's a question as to whether the Bluetooth technology will even work in that instance. The theory is that you can decide how close or how far someone is based on how strong or weak the Bluetooth signal is. And so research done by Trinity College Dublin said that, okay, that might be true in an open field, but in the real world, in a town or a city where there's lots of different things that can interfere with signal, it's not so easy to do that. And even whether your phone is in your pocket or whether it's in your bag or whether it's face to face, it's side to side, that can all impact how strong or weak the signal is. And if you're indoors, the signal can bounce around a little bit, which gives a misreading too. So there's a big question there as to whether it will actually work in the way it's supposed to, even in normal conditions. And even if, you know, you take out the false positives of people who are next to each other through a wall or through a piece of glass.
Right. And with all of those questions, what about the cost of it? Because health software and Ireland has a somewhat checkered history with regard to expenditure. So what about this? Do we know anything about the cost of developing this?
Nothing at the moment. And again, this goes back to that whole thing about what the app does. I suppose the more features it has and the more off the shelf or unique tech that's underneath the hood will dictate the cost of it. I mean, we probably will find out the price eventually. It is worth bearing in mind that this is a major undertaking. It's something that hasn't been done before. The time frame is extremely short for this kind of app development. And I think if people find that it actually manages to make life get back to some level of normality, and if it helps people identify infections quicker, it might justify a price tag, even if it's a high one. But there is that significant chance that it won't be really much use at all. And that will obviously make it seem like a waste of money, even if it's relatively cheap and at the end of the day.
All right. Thanks a million, Adam.
Thanks, Tom.
And finally today, many European countries have begun to open up their borders to outsiders. Some never really locked down for insiders, specifically Sweden. And that's what I've been talking about to our Europe editor, Tony Connolly. Howdy.
Hey.
Okay, Tony, I suppose it's fitting to ask, are you planning on going anywhere nice this year on your holidays? I can ask you that now. You being in continental Europe.
This is the question. Well, borders are opening as we speak almost, but the question is, if you cross that border, will you be let into your own country when you come back? We actually last night tried to sit down and figure out where we would go for our holidays and what the constraints were, and we realized we couldn't even begin the conversation because we didn't know what borders would be open where. I mean, I'm obviously keen to get back to Ireland, possibly in August, but we don't know when Belgian restrictions will be lifted, which would mean that I can get back to Belgium without having to go into quarantine. You know, I'm hoping by August, you know, things will have improved, but, you know, who knows where we'll be by then. I suppose once all the countries start lifting their restrictions, you know, in a bundle, then does that mean that airlines will suddenly be opening their ticket sales and you'll have a kind of a stampede of passengers and prices will start to soar? I mean, that's going to be another question for people. That's a kind of a commercial consideration by airlines. Do they ramp up the prices or do they keep them low in the hope that that will encourage people to buy tickets? But then if too many people buy tickets, then how does that impact the social distancing on planes and in airports? So it's like... You know, for every question, there's 15 more questions come into the frame, and it's really hard to know how everything's going to untangle itself. We are at a moment now where there's a real sense that things are starting to move, perhaps a bit quicker than people were anticipating. I mean, today being Wednesday, we had Italy announcing that they were going to open their borders to, you know, all European member states, and they were really encouraging people to travel to Italy to try and get the tourism industry back on its feet. But take Austria, for example, a neighbouring country of Italy, of course, they have announced that from June the 15th, they'll be opening their borders to their neighbours like Czech Republic, Slovenia, Hungary, but not Italy. So you can see that's come down badly with the Italian government already.
Yeah, bit of historic tension there anyway, but... Let's not rake over that.
Let's leave that to one side.
Well, let's go to a country for a proper look that hasn't really had the same level of restriction in place. And there were questions being answered by the chief epidemiologist, Anders Tegnell, today. And that's Sweden. He was, I suppose this is newsworthy in and of itself, a public official standing up saying, yeah, you know what, maybe we didn't get everything right.
Yeah, so this has been quite a big story today. As you know, Sweden has been an outlier in Europe and the world, really. It has, more than any country, pursued a much more relaxed approach. It had a much more gentle lockdown compared to the other Nordic neighbours and most of Europe. Part of that was explained by the very high trust that people have in Swedish institutions and the public authorities in Sweden. The corollary of that is that the public authorities felt that they could trust Swedes to do the right thing. So rather than have laws imposing a lockdown, the authorities basically asked Swedes to be responsible, to keep social distancing. But at the same time, they allowed gatherings of 50 people, up to 50 people. They allowed children to go to school under the age of 16. They pretty much kept bars and restaurants and cafes open, and a lot of companies stayed open as well. And I think part of the thinking there was that because of this level of trust that operated both ways, it would work. And secondly, that if you protect the people who need protecting, like the old and other vulnerable groups, then you can allow a degree of herd immunity to take hold, and that Sweden would be better placed to survive a second wave. Now, there were criticisms of this policy from within Sweden, and there was a bit of a debate among experts, but by and large, the public seemed to like it, not least obviously because their lives were less inconvenienced than elsewhere in Europe. But today, Anders Tegnell, as you say, has started to acknowledge that that may have been the wrong approach, mainly because the death toll in Sweden has been way higher than anywhere else in Scandinavia.
Yeah, we were talking to Luke O'Neill from Trinity College. He's a professor in the field of immunology in Trinity College. And he was saying, from a scientific point of view, and purely from a scientific point of view, it was the perfect test case. You had Sweden taking one set of measures, which is broadly demographically similar to Norway, its next door neighbour. And the chance taken by Sweden, the contrast between Sweden and indeed Denmark, some contrast.
Yeah, I mean, so far, Sweden has now had nearly 4,500 deaths. Denmark has had 580, and Norway has had 237. Population-wise, they're about half of the Swedish population, but still, that's a huge discrepancy in the mortality rate. And that has had spillover effects politically, because Denmark has opened its borders to Norway and to Germany, but not to Sweden. And yet Sweden has opened its borders to Denmark. So the huge bridge across the Øresund Straits between Denmark and Sweden, just crossing from Copenhagen into Malmo there, that opened at the weekend. And there were huge tailbacks of Danes flocking into Sweden, where a lot of them have holiday homes or second homes, but nobody coming in the opposite direction. And this was a rather awkward moment between the sort of two Nordic brothers, Denmark and Sweden. I mean, this morning, Anders Tegnell said that, okay, you know, if we knew more at the beginning, if we were to do it all again, we would perhaps place the Swedish policy somewhere between what they did and what the rest of the world did. So they're not saying that they were wrong completely, but saying that in hindsight, perhaps they could have done things somewhat differently. Interesting that the Swedish Health Ministry issued a statement after that radio interview this morning saying it's too early to conclude whether Sweden's approach was the right one or the wrong one. And that was going to be another day's work.
Somewhere between what the rest of the world did and what Sweden did, you might conclude that's possibly what Denmark did, given that they were able to open the schools relatively early by comparison to even other European neighbours. But maybe it'd kill the Swedes to say the Danes, our nearest neighbours and sometimes rivals, got it more right than we did.
Well, I mean, it is, yeah. I mean, I think there's definitely that kind of neighbourly tension filtering into this performance question of countries, and you know, no less than between Ireland and the UK. Yeah. I mean, there's been quite a bit of froth on social media about whether Ireland outperformed the UK per capita in its handling of the pandemic, and that's also been happening in between countries like Denmark and Sweden. And it also is quite intriguing, given that Sweden is famous for a precautionary approach to everything. I mean, they are
most notably alcohol.
Alcohol, yeah. I mean, they're known as the safety junkies of the world. They sell indoor helmets for children so that they don't bang their heads, for example. and other.
Mind
other,
you, they could have exported a lot of them in the lockdown.
That's right. They would have, yeah. They could have refloated their economy, I think. But yeah, I mean, all of these kind of tensions and rivalries are certainly going to linger in the public sphere for a long time, because each country is going to have its own investigation afterwards as to how things went, and there is going to be an inquiry in Sweden into the approach they took. And it was very much an approach that was led by the public health authorities rather than politicians, much more so than what we've seen in the UK and Ireland, where scientists were given a very large degree of public prominence and authority. I think in the UK now, you can see that the political control has and preeminence has started to overtake that of scientists. You know, they are a lot more worried in the UK about the effects of the lingering lockdown on the economy. But in Sweden, you know, the vast majority of the public supported what Anders Tegnell was doing and his approach. But that may now come under question as we see that the death toll in Sweden is a lot higher than its neighbours.
All right. Thanks, Tony. But before we go, I suppose it's worth mentioning you got the plug in last week. I get the plug in this week. Brexit Republic, the other podcast that myself, yeah, yourself and Sean Whelan do, is back next,
yeah,
week.
Yeah, not forgetting Brexit. I mean, who could have forgotten it? But yeah, delighted to announce that we're going to be back next week with Brexit Republic. Obviously, we decided to take it off the air because everyone was consumed by the pandemic and all our own resources and attention and energy was being directed into that particular story. But Brexit has been bubbling along, as you know, in the meantime, and we have a third round of negotiations this week out of four negotiations altogether. So we can take stock of everything that's happened since the pandemic struck on the Brexit front and where things are at, because of course June is going to be a fairly important month in terms of stock taking and assessing where the negotiations are going.
Right, a podcast that will be not unlike Rip Van Winkle's first trip down the mountain going, did I miss anything?
Indeed, we'll make sure they haven't.
Alrighty, thanks very much, Tony.
Colm, good to talk to you as always.
All thanks the best, good luck to you, guys. And that's all for this episode of Pandemic. We're back tomorrow with more. In the meantime, do get in contact with suggestions or questions by email to colm.omongain@rte.ie. That's colm.omongain@rte.ie, or on Twitter @ColmOmongain. Do subscribe through your usual podcast platform to get this podcast regularly. Reviews are welcome, and of course, nice reviews even more welcome. So until tomorrow, take care. See you.